Christie and Joe Biden. Here's a caller asking about exactly those two people.
David, do you think that Christie would beat Joe Biden? And my next question would be, do you think Chris Christie, if he did win the nominee, would he start going anti-woke crap too?
Okay, so two questions there. If it were Christie versus Biden, does Christie have a shot? Second question, if Christie became the nominee, would he go anti-woke? Let's answer the second one first because it's simpler. The anti-woke stuff is more useful within the Republican primary than in the general election. Why? Because most of the country actually agrees with the, quote, woke side of most issues. So if Chris Christie doesn't go anti-woke while running in the primary, he is not going to go anti-woke as a general election candidate. That I am confident in. The first question, if the matchup were Christie versus Biden in November of 2024, could Christie win? I believe the answer is yes. I believe that if MAGA was soundly defeated, if Trump really crumbles, and what I mean by that is he's indicted a third time, it becomes absolutely impossible to even be out on the campaign trail because he's just busy with three different criminal defenses. Republicans abandon him. Imagine they select Chris Christie. I believe that this would actually create a resurgence among the Republican electorate where all of these folks who have been dissuaded from even participating because they're disgusted with Trump or they just think Trump is the wrong direction for the party. I believe all of those folks would get engaged. I believe also that there are some people who voted for Biden in 2020 because they were so disgusted with Trump, who, if there was a reasonable Republican, would actually go back to voting Republican. And so I'm not here to tell you Christie would definitely beat Joe Biden. But if Trump is running even with Biden, I do believe that Chris Christie has a solid shot of defeating Biden in a general election. I'm not hoping for that. I'm answering the caller's question. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. We're going to talk about the coming heat wave in Texas. Are they actually prepared for it this time? We will talk about Cornel West now after announcing that he's running as a People's Party candidate, also seeking the Green Party nomination. I'm going to be honest with you. It's all a complete and total mess. And we will give you the latest not so good news about Tesla's self-driving system, which I have tested out myself, by the way. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Get instant access by signing up at JoinPack.
WRCT in sound from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The plaintiffs invited the Supreme Court to not only strike down ICWA, but to gut the legal foundation of tribal sovereignty. And yesterday, in a stunning defeat for the plaintiffs, the Supreme Court said no.
In a surprise decision, the Supreme Court votes to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act in a major victory for tribal sovereignty. We'll get the latest, then go to Montana, where calls are growing for authorities to investigate the death of Micah Westwolf, a 22-year-old Indigenous woman who died after being hit by a car driven by a suspected white nationalist whose children are named Aryan and Nation. Then we talk to Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. He's calling on the Biden administration to declassify its report on the death of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was shot dead by an Israeli soldier.
This is an American citizen. We have a duty to pursue the facts wherever they lead, as Secretary Blinken himself said.
And we look at the black maternal health crisis following the tragic death of Olympic track and field star Tori Bowie, who died last month home alone after going into labor.
It highlights the problem where black mothers are, you know, not receiving the appropriate care and succumbing to issues that really are treatable and normally wouldn't have such awful outcomes.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Greek authorities have arrested 9 Egyptian nationals and charged them with people smuggling after their overloaded fishing vessel capsized and sank in deep waters off the coast of southern Greece Wednesday. Over 100 people were rescued, but hope is fading for an estimated 500 others who remain missing. That includes as many as 100 children who, witnesses say, were traveling below deck. It's the deadliest shipwreck off the Greek coast this year, possibly among the deadliest ever in the central Mediterranean. Protests in support of the migrants have erupted across Greece amid reports that a Greek Coast Guard vessel escorted the trawler for hours and failed to properly render aid as the vessel capsized. On Thursday, Greek opposition leader Alexis Tsipras visited with survivors at the port of Kalamata, where he condemned the European Union's policies on refugees and migrants.
I want to say there are huge political responsibilities with the migration policy that Europe has been following for years. A migration policy that turns the Mediterranean, our seas, into watery graves. And I think it is time to speak the truth, because this policy has to change.
Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has taken credit for sending dozens of migrants to Los Angeles in a move condemned by Democrats as cruel and inhumane. It's the latest in a series of similar moves by Republican governors in recent months. On Wednesday afternoon, a busload of 42 migrants, including 8 children, arrived in Los Angeles after a 23-hour ride from McAllen, Texas, without food, they said. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass blasted Abbott, writing in a statement, quote, "It's abhorrent that an American elected official is using human beings as pawns in his cheap political game," she said. Los Angeles City Council member Aunisis Hernandez also condemned Governor Abbott.
He's obviously a a person who's been elected that is not strong enough to meet the moment in his state. But that's okay, because all these people here in Los Angeles and in California are more than capable of welcoming these folks here, because Los Angeles is a place and a city for everyone. And we'll keep pushing for our sanctuary policies to make sure that immigrants and migrants know that they are safe here, that they are welcome here. 1.3 million immigrants make up the city of Los Angeles. They are the nervous system, the heart of this city, and we have their back.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill Thursday barring transgender college athletes in Texas from competing on sports teams that align with their gender identities. This follows other anti-LGBTQ legislation recently passed in Texas, including a ban on gender-affirming care for transgender minors. In Ohio, Republican lawmakers have merged two anti-LGBTQIA bills into a single piece of legislation. The Ohio House is set to vote next week on the combined bill, which would ban puberty blockers or hormones for everyone under 18, bar transgender women and girls from female-only sports teams in Ohio, schools and colleges, and forbid Medicaid from paying for gender-affirming care for youth. It would also limit discussions of gender identity and sexual orientation in classrooms. The ACLU reports it's tracking 491 anti-LGBTQ bills in the U.S. during this year's legislative session. The Supreme Court has upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act in a ruling that protects Native children from being removed from their tribal communities for adoption or foster care in non-Native homes. In a stunning 7-2 ruling, Justice Amy Coney Barrett rejected an argument from Republican-led states and white families who argued the system is based on race, writing, quote, "In sum, Congress's power to legislate with respect to Indians is well established and broad." Indigenous leaders are celebrating Thursday's ruling, saying the 1978 law helps to preserve their families' traditions and cultures. After headlines, we'll speak with Rebecca Nagel, Cherokee writer, award-winning journalist, and host of This Land podcast. In Texas, at least three people were killed Thursday as a tornado tore through a trailer park in Panhandle City of Perryton. More than 75 people were injured. About 200 homes were destroyed. There's triple-digit heat in the forecast for the region this weekend, with temperature records set to fall in Houston and New Orleans, and 10 million people under excessive heat warnings through Saturday night. Authorities on Mexico's Pacific Coast say hundreds of wild birds that have washed up along the shore died as a result of abnormally warm ocean waters resulting from the climate crisis and the warming trend known as El Niño. Mexico's health ministry reports at least six people have died this year from heat-related illnesses, with more extreme temperatures forecast for this weekend. On Thursday, the European Union's climate agency said global surface air temperatures briefly rose by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels earlier this month for the first time ever. That's the maximum global temperature rise agreed to under the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Here in New York, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Thursday countries must immediately phase out the burning of coal, oil, and gas, calling them incompatible with human survival. Guterres also accused fossil fuel companies of attempting to kneecap progress on the climate crisis.
Current policies are taking the world to a 2.8 degree temperature rise by the end of the century. That spells catastrophe, yet the collective response remains pitiful. We are hurtling towards disaster, eyes wide open, with far too many willing it all on wishful thinking, unproven technologies, and silver bullet solutions. It's time to wake up and step up.
As Secretary of State Tony Blinken makes his way to China to discuss the war in Ukraine, U.S.-China relations, and other issues, Russia has fired a fresh volley of missiles on Ukraine's capital. Earlier today, explosions rang out across Kyiv, where Ukraine's military claims it shot down six hypersonic missiles, six cruise missiles, and two reconnaissance drones. The daytime attacks came as seven African heads of state, led by South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, visited Kyiv in a bid to kickstart peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. Meanwhile, top Pentagon officials called Thursday for U.S. allies to continue pouring weapons into Ukraine. Speaking from a meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group in Belgium, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin asked allies to, quote, dig deep to provide Ukraine with air defense systems and more ammunition. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Milley acknowledged Ukraine's military is suffering heavy losses as it presses a counteroffensive against entrenched forces in eastern Ukraine.
There are several hundred thousand Russian troops dug in prepared positions all along the front line. Ukraine has begun their attack, and they are making steady progress. This is a very difficult fight. It is a very violent fight, and it will likely take a considerable amount of time and at high cost.
A federal grand jury has indicted 21-year-old Air National Guard member Jack Teixeira on 6 counts of willful retention and transmission of classified information over the recent leak of highly classified Pentagon intelligence documents. Teixeira has been jailed since April. If convicted, he faces up to 10 years in prison for each charge. Teixeira is accused of violating the same part of the Espionage Act used by federal prosecutors to charge Donald Trump over his mishandling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. Trump was released without having to pay bond after pleading not guilty at his arraignment in a Miami federal court on Tuesday. Back in the United States, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union has reached a tentative agreement on a 6-year labor contract covering some 22,000 dock workers at all 29 ports along the West Coast. The deal, which is subject to ratification by members, caps more than a year of negotiations after the union's previous contract expired last July. And Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo has signed legislation allocating $380 million in public funds for a new Major League Baseball ballpark in Las Vegas. The bill clears the way for the Athletics to apply to the MLB to relocate from Oakland, California, where the team has played for over half a century. Oakland A's executives hired more than a dozen lobbyists to press lawmakers in Nevada's capital, Carson City, to approve a $1.5 billion stadium, arguing it'll create jobs and boost Las Vegas's economy. Writing about the move in The Nation magazine, sports editor Dave Zirin commented, quote, "This is about billionaire sports owners demanding socialism for the rich and seasonal service industry work for the laboring class. They are urban hostage takers demanding a king's ransom from the public trough," Zirin wrote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with a major victory at the Supreme Court in a case that could have gutted Native American sovereignty. On Thursday, the court upheld the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act that protects Native children from being removed from their tribal communities for fostering or adoption in non-Native homes. Tribal leaders say the law helps to preserve their families, traditions, and cultures. In a stunning 7-2 ruling, Justice Amy Coney Barrett rejected an argument from Republican-led states and white families who argued the system is based on race, writing, quote, "In sum, Congress's power to legislate with respect to Indians is well established and broad." Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote in a concurring opinion, quote, "The Indian Child Welfare Act did not emerge from a vacuum. It came as a direct response to the mass removal of Indian children from their families during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s by state officials and private parties," unquote. Many are also taking note of the final paragraph of Justice Gorsuch's opinion. It reads, quote, "Often, Native American tribes have come to this court seeking justice only to leave with bowed heads and empty hands. But that is not because this court has no justice to offer them. Our Constitution reserves for the tribes a place, an enduring place, in the structure of American life. It promises them sovereignty for as long as they wish to keep it. And it secures that promise by divesting states of authority over Indian affairs and by giving the federal government certain significant but limited and enumerated powers aimed at building a lasting peace. In adopting the Indian Child Welfare Act, Congress exercised that lawful authority to secure the right of Indian parents to raise their families as they please, the right of Indian children to grow in their culture, and the right of Indian communities to resist fading into the twilight of history." Gorsuch concluded, "All of that is in keeping with the Constitution's original design," unquote. Meanwhile, Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas both wrote dissents, with Thomas objecting to, quote, regulating state court child custody proceedings of U.S. citizens who may never have even set foot on Indian lands merely because the child involved happens to be an Indian, unquote. For more on all of this, we're joined in Oklahoma by Rebecca Nagel, a Cherokee writer, award-winning journalist who followed this case closely in a piece for The Nation headlined, "The Story of Baby O and the Case That Could Gut Native Sovereignty." She's also the host of This Land podcast. In season two, she's been reporting on how the far right is using Native children to attack American Indian tribes and advance a conservative agenda. Rebecca, welcome back to Democracy Now! Please first respond to this, what shocked many Native American tribes and communities, and also tell us the story of Baby O.
Thank you, Amy, so much for having me and for covering this important issue. Really, what happened with this case is that for the past decade, special interest groups have used this law, the Indian Child Welfare Act, as a vehicle to launch a broader attack on tribes and tribal sovereignty. And so the arguments that they invited the Supreme Court to adopt would have not only gotten rid of the Indian Child Welfare Act, but it would have really destabilized the area of law a lot of people call federal Indian law. And instead of taking that invitation, the Supreme Court responded with a very, very strong no. One of the ways that these special interest groups have advanced these cases is by really misrepresenting the facts on the ground and what happened when these non-Native foster parents tried to adopt Native children. So it's a complicated case. There's multiple foster parents. One of those couples is a couple named the Librettis from Nevada. When a child was placed with them through Safe Haven, within a few weeks, her father was identified. It was identified that her father was a descendant of a federally recognized tribe and that she was eligible for enrollment. And the process started for her to be placed with a family member. And the Librettis' response to that was extraordinary. I mean, they wrote a letter to that child's grandmother asking her to disenroll so that ICWA would not imply. They managed to rope social workers into their plot who either refused to call relatives who were possible placements or when they made those calls, tried to talk the relatives out. And basically, Nevada social workers strong-armed the tribe into entering a settlement. And so, and we found, you know, stories like that in all of the underlying custody cases. And so what really happened in this case was rather than non-Native foster parents being able to adopt, being prevented from adopting Native kids, for the most part, they won custody. And the people who faced the real hurdles were the Native relatives who just wanted to keep their young relatives in their family.
And so what ultimately happened to Baby O, and how did this case make it to the Supreme Court?
So Baby O, like many of the other children in the underlying custody cases, all of the children in the underlying custody cases have been adopted, and those adoptions are final. And so Baby O was adopted by the Librettis, and that's who she's being raised by, despite there being several blood relatives that came forward during her case who wanted to raise her. And that was one of the things that I was relieved to see in the Supreme Court case. You know, this case has been on stilts since it was filed in federal court. All of the underlying adoptions have been long final. And normally, when that happens, a lawsuit is over. You know, there needs to be a controversy for a lawsuit to move forward. And I think one of the things that the Supreme Court signaled in this ruling is that it is more dedicated to the rule of the law and the rule of civil procedure than the politics of this case. Because one of the things that the plaintiffs invited the Supreme Court to do was to ignore those things and instead to make a political decision. And they rejected that, which I think is good, not just for Native nations and families, but for the rule of law.
So, Rebecca Nagel, can you talk about the comments of Justice Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett? These are some of the most conservative members of the court. And the fact that this shocked Native Americans around the country. And to also talk about why would, oh, organizations like gambling casinos be very invested in this case? When you talk about, by the way, ICWA, that's the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Yeah, so the special interest groups that have been attacking ICWA for the past decade kind of fall into three buckets. So it's a handful of private adoption attorneys. And if you look at the private adoption industry, they've fought basically any regulation that would result in there being less children who are available for adoption. There are some right-wing organizations like the Goldwater Institute. We also found a lot of money flowing into the anti-ICWA campaign from the Bradley Foundation. And then who's really spearheading the effort now is a law firm called Gibson Dunn and a lawyer there named Matthew McGill. And last January, the other shoe dropped. And so they actually, Gibson Dunn and Matthew McGill, filed a lawsuit on behalf of a casino developer saying that tribal gaming was racial discrimination against him because he could not make as much money as the tribes. And so they've basically used the exact same arguments that they're making to attack ICWA to attack tribal gaming. And so I think the hope for them was that if they won this case, they could sort of have the follow-up case to attack tribal gaming. And fortunately, they were unsuccessful. A lot of people are surprised by Gorsuch and Barrett. I'm not. I think that if you listen to oral arguments, Barrett was really positioning herself in the middle on this case. And so when I saw that the opinion was authored by Barrett, I had a sigh of relief with that news. And then as I continue reading, I was even more relieved. We've had a lot of liberal justices that have sat on the bench that have not been friendly to tribal sovereignty because I think that they don't understand it. I think Justice Ginsburg is somebody that people point to a lot. I think it is good for tribes to have justices that really understand the law and how that law relates to the Constitution. I think what Gorsuch did in his concurring opinion that we almost never see, was that he talked about the long history of the U.S. government removing Native children from their families. And the reason that that is important is that he's talking about why ICWA is important from the perspective of Native people. And I think that often our perspectives and our stories and our histories aren't told at venues like the Supreme Court. So to see that coming from a justice was really powerful.
And so where does this case go from here in terms of Native American law, U.S. law?
Yeah. So, in the past decade, ICWA has been challenged almost as many times as the Affordable Care Act. This case is the closest and the furthest they have ever gotten in their effort to overturn ICWA. And they got a very, very strong rejection from the Supreme Court. And so I think time will tell whether or not they will bring other cases. Our reporting found other cases that are still sort of in family court that these corporate lawyers are swooping in to represent non-Native families. So they'll continue to do that. What's next for the Supreme Court is yet to be seen. The past few years, we've had some great decisions. We've had some bad decisions. It's been a bit of a roller coaster. But I think what's important about this case is that we're seeing not only the Supreme Court, but I think the public show more of an interest and more of a knowledge about the Constitution and tribal sovereignty and how all these things work. I think some of our biggest barriers at the Supreme Court has been ignorance. And I think seeing that knowledge come out in the Supreme Court opinion is really encouraging.
Rebecca Nagel, we want to thank you for being with us. Cherokee writer and award-winning journalist. We'll link to your piece in The Nation, headlined "The Story of Baby O and the Case That Could Gut Native Sovereignty." She's also the host of This Land podcast. Coming up, we're going to Montana, where calls are growing for authorities to investigate the death of Micah Westwolf, a 22-year-old indigenous woman who died after being hit by a car driven by a suspected white nationalist. Her two children's names are Aryan and Nation. But first, we'll talk to Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. He's calling on the Biden administration to declassify its report on the death of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, shot dead by an Israeli soldier. Stay with us. Call police, but if I don't see you in the future, I'll see you in the pasture. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's continuing to face criticism for its response to the killing last year of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier as she was reporting on an Israeli military raid just outside the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Al Jazeera reporter was shot while wearing a blue helmet and blue flak jacket, clearly emblazoned with the word press. Shireen Abu Akleh was one of the most prominent TV journalists in the Arab world. She was also a U.S. citizen. NBC News recently reported the FBI has not yet spoken to any key witnesses in the case. Israel's refused to cooperate with the probe, and Palestinian journalists who were with Shireen at the time of her death say the FBI has never contacted them. Many of the journalists who witnessed her death spoke to Al Jazeera correspondent Sharifa Belkadus for the documentary The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, which just won a George Polk Award. This is Shireen's producer, Ali Al-Samoudi, who was also shot that day.
When we made sure that there were no confrontations, we started walking slowly, with slow steps.
And about 25 seconds later, here they are walking with Shadha and Mujahid up the street, all in their press jackets, just past the spot where Salim had a view of the military.
Suddenly, a round of bullets was fired. I shouted, "Shireen, they're shooting at us. We have to get out of here." Just as I was saying, "We have to get out of here," my shoulder exploded. I shouted, "Shireen, I was shot," or I said, "Shireen, they shot me."
After the first bullet, I was able to jump behind a short wall to take shelter. Shireen and Shatha reached me to jump and get out of the place, but they couldn't.
They started firing at us. I immediately pressed record. I saw Ali was wounded. He walked away. Shireen was behind the tree. I could still see her hiding behind the tree.
The last words that Shireen said was, "Ali has been wounded. Ali has been wounded." I mean, these ears, every day, all the time, Shireen's voice is repeating in my ears.
I stepped forward again and they started saying, "Shireen, Shireen," but they shot at us again.
I have a blank spot in my mind. I don't remember how I got behind the tree. I got behind the tree and turned around to see if Shireen could come to where I was. At that point, I saw Shireen falling to the ground. I didn't understand that she had been gravely wounded.
I stepped forward and saw Shireen on the ground. I'm holding the camera. I bend down. I want to walk. To walk toward Shireen.
The whole time I wanted to shake her, to touch her, to move her. But I was also filled with fear because the tree was what was protecting us. And if I moved her, maybe she would be wounded again. I remember when I saw the blood on the ground. When the blood started coming out, that's when I realized that she had taken a bullet to the head. And I started shouting, "It's her head, her head."
An excerpt from The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh from Al Jazeera English's current affairs program, Fault Lines. The documentary recently won a George Polk Award for Foreign Television Reporting, one of the highest awards in journalism. Investigations by Al Jazeera, The New York Times, CNN, and other news outlets have challenged the official Israeli version of Shireen's killing. We're joined now by Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, who's called on the U.S. State Department to declassify a report on Shireen Abu Akleh's death on May 11, 2022, conducted by the U.S. Security Coordinator for Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Senator Chris Van Hollen joins us now from Kensington, Maryland. Thanks so much for being with us, Senator. Can you start off by explaining what this report is and what you're calling for?
Well, Amy, it's good to be with you. This was a report conducted by General Fenzel and his team. He's the U.S. Security Coordinator for Israel and the Palestinian Authorities. And he conducted an extensive review of what happened in the killing of Shireen. I should emphasize that his report is not an independent investigation. And he was not able to conduct an independent investigation because, as you indicated, Israeli authorities have not cooperated with the government. That's information I've received from the State Department. In other words, requests to deny the soldier in question or other members of the IDF unit have been denied. So it's not an independent investigation, but it does shed very important light on the conduct of the IDF unit in question on the day of the shooting of Shireen. And also, more broadly, reaches conclusions about the conduct of other IDF units in the West Bank. And it's my view that the report should be declassified because it is important to getting to accountability in the shooting death of Shireen Abu Akleh. And I believe its release will help save lives going forward.
So what has the Biden administration said about releasing this document, and what process does it have to go through?
Well, they have not yet responded to the request to release the document. I should say that in this particular case, the final classification process has not yet been completed. The overall report that I reviewed, after much insistence, is classified top secret, but it has actually not gone through its final classification process. So we are very focused right now on making the case that it's important to release the findings of this document to ensure a greater accountability in the shooting death of this American citizen and journalist. It includes important information on the killing of Shireen, and because I believe that it will reveal additional information that would hopefully result in more accountability for IDF units on the West Bank, something that President Biden has called for and something that Secretary Blinken has called for.
Senator Van Hollen, how does this report differ from the U.S. Security Coordinator's report from last year, which you were very critical of?
Well, as it turns out, last year's report was not really a report. It was just a very cursory finding, a conclusion based on a very preliminary review, not of independent information, but information that had been provided by the Israeli government, by the Palestinian Authority. So it turned out that there was no real report there when we asked for it. So now the USSC has conducted an extensive review of all the analyses that have been done and reached certain judgments about what happened that day and certain judgments, again, about the conduct of other IDF units. And I just think it's really important that this report, which is not a paragraph like the original, findings, but an 8-page report, I believe it should be released.
And why is this report classified as top secret in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. I think that the findings are clearly critical of the conduct of the IDF unit in question. And again, this is why Secretary Blinken has also called upon the government of Israel to review its rules of engagement on the West Bank. And he's been rebuffed. In other words, the government of Israel told him to go take a hike. And that's another reason it's really important that this report be released.
I wanted to play for you Shireen Abu Akleh's niece. I interviewed her in December. This is Lina Abu Akleh.
We were actually very encouraged by the news that the FBI will be investigating. This is something we've been calling on from day one since Shireen was a U.S. citizen, and it's the duty of the United States to investigate any crimes carried out by a foreign army outside towards against a U.S. citizen. And we stand ready to support the U.S. in conducting this independent and thorough investigation, following all the evidence where it leads up and down the chain of command. And we've seen how Israeli army is unable and unwilling to investigate themselves. That's why it's really important for the FBI to be investigating. And we also hope that the United States, the FBI, will employ all tools necessary to get the answers that we've been asking regarding the killing of Shireen, but also to lead to accountability and justice. That's what we want. We want there to be accountability. We want there to be justice.
So that's Lina Abu Akleh, the niece of Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed on May 11, 2022, as she covered an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in occupied West Bank. Shireen is a U.S. citizen. Shireen is a Palestinian-American journalist. Senator Chris Van Hollen, what obligation does the United States have when it believes another state, in this case an ally, Israel, has killed a U.S. citizen?
Well, it's my belief that the United States has an absolute obligation to get to the bottom of what happened, to hold the individuals accountable. Or in this case, potentially the IDF unit accountable. And that is something that we should do when you have the wrongful killing of a U.S. citizen. Look, you know, President Biden has been eloquent about calling for the release of U.S. Journalists who are currently detained around the world. He's been eloquent about trying to get to the bottom of what happened to Austin Tice, as have I in both those other cases, determined to try to make sure that American citizens and journalists are protected. That same protection needs to extend to American citizen and journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. And that is the obligation of the U.S. government, and it is a still unfulfilled obligation.
The FBI has also opened an investigation into the case. Do you know anything about this investigation, Senator?
Well, my understanding is the FBI investigation is ongoing, although the FBI will not publicly confirm whether or not the investigation is ongoing. But my understanding is the FBI investigators have talked to some people. But you raised a very important point, which is that the FBI will also ultimately require the cooperation of the government of Israel to be able to make any final conclusions with respect to an independent investigation, right? The investigation done by the U.S. security coordinator was not an independent investigation because he was not allowed to interview witnesses, including members of the IDF unit in question. And the FBI, in my view, is going to have a very difficult time making independent judgments as to exactly what happened that day without the cooperation of the government of Israel. And that is another reason it's important that the Biden administration press harder.
Are you going to demand that at least the FBI, even if they don't have access on Israel's side, to the Palestinian journalists who were there that day, one of whom was shot, who were not contacted for this report?
Well, the FBI certainly should be interviewing all the witnesses, including the witnesses that you just mentioned, Al Jazeera, journalists that were on the ground, and others. Yes, the FBI should be doing all of that.
And did the U.S. Security Coordinator's report shed any light on Israeli claims of crossfire, since video footage and eyewitnesses dispute this? And also, since you read it, did the report confirm whether or not there is more body camera footage from the IDF unit from the moments around the shooting?
Well, I can't get into the details of the report because it is still classified. But let me just say the conclusions of the report, I believe, if made public, would result in saving lives. And I do believe would bring more accountability to this case, because that does shed very important light on the conduct and misconduct of the IDF unit in question. So this is exactly why I think it's important that the report be declassified.
Let me ask a final question. The first USSC report found no reason to believe the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh was intentional. Does this new report come to a different conclusion?
Well, this new report cannot shed any new light on the question of intentionality because the USSC was denied access to the witnesses. You know, it's my view that you can only get to the state of mind of individuals by interviewing the individual who pulled the trigger, as well as those that were immediately around that soldier. And so long as that access is denied, you can't shed any more new light on that question.
Senator Chris Van Hollen, I want to thank you for being with us. Democratic Senator from Maryland calling for the release of the U.S. government report on the shooting death of the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Coming up, we go to Montana, where calls are growing for authorities to investigate the death of Micah Westwolf, a 22-year-old indigenous woman who died after being hit by a car driven by a white nationalist. We'll speak with Micah's parents. Stay with us. That's Micah Westwolf playing a ukulele. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman. This week, community members in Montana held a series of Justice to Be Seen walks to demand justice for many indigenous people killed or hit by vehicles there along Highway 93. They're focusing on Micah, Micah Westwolf, 22-year-old indigenous woman struck and killed in March by a driver as she was walking home along the highway in the early morning hours. The driver was identified as Sunny White, a suspected white nationalist whose two children who were in the car are reportedly named Aryan and Nation. They were in the car at the time of the crash. Sunny White has not been charged in connection with Micah's death. Micah Westwolf was a member of Blackfeet tribe, also Diné, Cree, and Klamath. She was an avid athlete and poet. This is Micah speaking in 2016 about graduating from Big Sky High School.
My name is Michael Westwolf. I'm a student at Missoula Big Sky High School and a member of the Blackfeet Nation. I am also Navajo, Cree, and Klamath. Earning a high school diploma would mean that I could get into a good college or help my people get a good job. My mom helps me a lot because she always helps me out with my work when I'm struggling, or she always gets after me to do my work and always tells me to try my hardest and tells me that I can do anything I want if I just put my mind to it. My plans after graduation is to go to the SKC College. What I want to do is there's a program there that is like you can be a dentist assistant, and that's what I want to do.
Michael Westwolf speaking in 2016. Her life was tragically cut short in March. And for more on the calls for justice in her death, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Erica Shelby, a tribal legal advocate for missing, murdered Indigenous women. And we begin in Arlee, Montana, with Micah's parents, her mother, Carissa Heavy Runner, and father, Kevin Howard. Our deepest condolences for your loss. Can you tell us about your daughter, Micah? What kind of person she was, what were her aspirations, and why you're walking now, why you're on this walk to demand justice?
Hi. Yes, Micah was a very loud, curious, energetic, very intelligent, active little girl until she was, you know, a young woman. She read a lot. She did a lot of writing. She got to travel all the way to Nepal. She had a love for being outdoors. She wanted to hike everywhere, camp in the mountains, travel. And she wanted to go back to Nepal and climb the mountains there. She fell in love with it there, and she danced powwows before she could walk, and I had to help her. And she just was a strong, intelligent Native woman. And I know she would be right here if I wasn't in this situation for fighting for justice for my daughter and it was for someone else. She would be right beside me. She was a little activist.
We're doing this walk. We want Lake County to investigate these kind of crimes. Something that in the past they haven't done. So if they're not going to do it, we're gonna do it for them, and we're gonna force them to do it.
And Erica Shelby, you're in Washington, D.C. Explain what you believed happened. Was this an unintentional car crash, just a tragedy, or why you believe that Micah Westwolf may have been deliberately run down?
Well, when we spoke with James Lapotka, the county attorney, he explained to us that, you know, the talks had come back on Sonny. He had also taken it from Micah, which we still don't know why. And she had trace amounts of fentanyl and meth, nanograms.
That was Sonny?
There was no skid marks, no brake marks. Yeah, Sonny White. And so...
The driver.
And so, I mean, it's not regulated like THC or alcohol where you can give it a DUI at a certain percentage. So how we understood it is it's legal to have these in your system and be on the road. But if they're trying to tell us that that wasn't a factor in her driving, well, then it can only leave that this was intentional.
And what does skid marks have to do with anything? The fact that there weren't skid marks. What does that say to you, Erica?
You know when you hit a deer. You know when you... We live in Montana. We hit deer. You know when you hit something. And the fact that she didn't brake, that she didn't swerve, that there's no sign of that, tells me, it indicates to me that at least it needs further investigation. And he can go off of, you know, the county attorney Lapotka said, you know, that nothing indicated that it was intentional to him. That's very superficial. And he's explained to us that he doesn't make determinations until he gets final reports. So how is he making determinations like that?
And what are you doing in Washington, Erica Shelby? What are your plans in bringing this case to the nation's capital?
Carissa and Kevin started this walk, and at the beginning, we didn't know how big it was. And then we got there, and there was so many people, and everybody has the same story about the same players, the same agencies, the same police, the same attorneys. And it's enough is enough. And they've been alienated, and they're isolated, and they're made to look crazy, and they eventually burn out. This system, it breaks us down. Where they're supposed to serve and protect, they're victim blaming. They're breaking us down. They're over-criminalizing us. We're overrepresented in prisons. We're overrepresented in the missing persons cases. We're overrepresented in the murdered cases. We're only 5% of the state population, but in 2021, we were 30% of the missing people's population. So something has to change. And I'm here to get the attention of the people in D.C., Tester, Daines, Murkowski, Schatz, everybody on that Senate Committee for Indian Affairs. The president. Everybody. He was the one who supported VAWA, who wrote VAWA, who got VAWA in there, the Violence Against Women Act. He made sure Indigenous women were included. Now we need him now. He spoke about the MMIW crisis at the State of the Union. He needs to come now and step up and see what's going on our res.
Carissa and Kevin, I want to give you the
last... It's happening on other reses, too.
I want to give you the last word as the parents of Micah. You are on the last day of the Micah Matters Walk. If you can talk about the significance of ending at the steps of the Lake County Courthouse, we just have about a minute.
For me personally, and I imagine for everyone else, it's going to say a lot. Us walking from Arlie all the way to the outside of the courthouse, because we want to hold them accountable. They need to step up. They need to hear us and see us. And the other families hear their stories and the frustration, and not only them, but the world, to listen to our stories and feel our pain, see our pain, that we are trying to make a difference and change and hold those in charge accountable.
Lake County has a long history of corruption and an unfair, blaming of Native Americans, and it's got to be fair and equal. So we're going to hold Lake County accountable. We're going to ensure that the Montana Highway Patrol is accountable. They have a long history of not investigating crimes against Native. If it was reversed, if it's a Native on white crime, those are heavily investigated, heavily enforced. So there's a disparity there that needs to end. So that's our goal.
Well, I want to thank you both. And again, our condolences to you both, Kevin Howard and Carissa Heavyrunner, parents of Micah Westwolf. And I want to thank Erica Shelby, tribal legal advocate for missing, murdered Indigenous women. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we end today's show, looking at the death of Olympic track and field star Tori Bowie and an often ignored issue, the Black maternal health crisis. Tori was just 32 years old when she died at home last month. The Orange County, Florida medical examiner reported she was 8 months pregnant and in labor when she died, most likely from eclampsia, a complication of pregnancy. Tori Bowie, who is Black, won bronze, silver, and gold medals in the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro. The CDC recently marked Black Maternal Health Week in April, noting Black women are 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy complications than white women. We're joined now by Dr. Carla Williams, board-certified OBGYN, who opted to have home births herself, an OBGYN, after her first hospital birthing experience. She's also a birth and postpartum doula. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you talk about the significance of this enormous disparity between white women and Black women dying in or before or right after childbirth, Dr. Williams?
Thank you so much for having me. It's just, it's incredible the disparities that you've mentioned and just how Black women are dying throughout the country, in New York State, in New York City especially, where it's up to 12 times more than white women. And it goes to show just that these patients, these women, their concerns aren't necessarily being heard. There's bias and there's racism within our medical institutions, and something needs to change drastically.
I mean, I wanted to read Bowie's Olympic teammate Tiana Bartoletta's tweet, which is just stunning, after learning of her death. She said, as of June 2023, three of the four members of Team USA's 4x100-meter relay team, who ran the second fastest time in history and brought home the gold medal, have nearly died or did die in childbirth. We deserve better. Hashtag Black Maternal Health Crisis. Dr. Williams.
Right. It's unacceptable, you know. It's saddening and it's maddening at the same time that that this is happening to Black and brown women, and that essentially nothing really can save you. You can be extremely well educated, you can be quote unquote high class, you can have all the money in the world, you can be, you know, record artists and Olympic medal winning athletes, and really nothing can spare you.
And I mean, the fact, Dr. Williams, that you're an OBGYN, that you yourself had two births at home after your first hospital experience, why? And how do you relate that to the disparities we're talking about?
Well, why the essentially what made me make that decision was having a bad experience with the birth of my first child in the hospital and experiencing discrimination within that stay. So when that happened to me, even being an OBGYN at that time, and feeling like I was getting subpar care and that my child was, I felt like definitely moving forward, out of hospital birth was what I wanted to choose for myself in order to have the best outcome. When I think about that, I think that every woman, every birthing person deserves to have an experience where, you know, they're taken care of, they're listened to, their concerns are validated, and their best interest is at mind.
What is it that doctors are missing? What is it that hospitals are not doing correctly? And what does this have to do with recognizing the pain of Black women?
I feel like what they're failing to do is listen to Black women. I feel like they're not listening to their complaints. I feel like they're taking things too lightly. I feel like they're intervening too much when maybe it's not necessary. I feel like there's not enough collaboration in the care with, for example, midwives that could be taking care of low-risk pregnancies and giving them more one-on-one attention that that those patients need. I feel like there has to more work needs to be done in order to take care of the birthing population the way that it should be, where, you know, high-risk pregnancies and whatnot is taken care of by more specialized providers, and we're taking care of low-risk pregnancies with midwives.
I want to end with your words on Instagram, Dr. Williams. You wrote, "We need to start measuring outcomes on more than just being alive. That's the baseline. The goal is empowered and healthy." Dr. Carla Williams, OBGYN, birth and postpartum doula, had two of her children at home after her first hospital experience. As we continue to cover the issue of the disparity in the lives of Black and white women, mothers. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pittsburgh.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk that makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up in stash behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some life that keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you a virgin on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy planted on their columns now that bind me. Or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. Just knowing that the world will not be cursing or forgiving when I walk along some railroad track and find you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you're just gentle on my mind. Though the wheat fields and the clotheslines, the junkyards and the highways come between us, some other woman's crying to her mother cause she turned and I was gone. Well, I still might run in silence, tears of joy might stain my face, and the summer sun might burn me till I'm blind. But not to where I cannot see you walking on the back roads by the river's flowing gently.
RCT, Pittsburgh. RCT, Pittsburgh.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. It makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up in stash behind your couch. And it's no